Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's always great to have you all joining us here. We're coming back with part two of our great episode with Barbara Morita. She's a physician assistant and DMAT responder who developed an affinity for what was going on with disaster response in the country of Cuba, the island nation just to the south of us. Cuba's been in the news a lot lately, and this is probably a really good time to do this episode. So this is part two of that episode. She had a lot to talk about to show us how the Cuban people are really very prepared for the hurricanes and other disasters that strike their island nation, and some of the lessons that might be well learned by the communities here in the United States. You can check out part one of that episode over at disasterpodcast.com. So if you're here checking out this episode for the first time, you might want to go back and check out the beginning of this two-part segment back there at disasterpodcast.com. Well, let's go ahead and get on into the rest of this segment with Barbara Morita, Sam Bradley, and of course, Dr. Joe Holly from Paragon Medical Education Group joining us to talk about what is going on with disaster preparedness in Cuba.
You know, I have a question too, Barb, and I don't want to, I know you have more to tell us, but I keep thinking, you know, I think Cuba, you know, I just peripherally watch the news anymore, but it seems like things are loosening up in terms of getting in there. But for so many years, Cuba was pretty much shut down for people wanting to go into the country. First of all, was that an issue for you? And then, you know, tell us more too about what you guys actually did there. And this is a fascinating they seem to have it right. But when you take a team down there, what is it you're actually doing?
So, so getting down there can be tricky. I take other groups down there, and sometimes we can get a permit, sometimes we couldn't. Now it would be much easier. But when we went down, we basically got introduced to the entire healthcare system. So we would go to what's called a consultorio, which is the neighborhood doctor nurse team office. And generally speaking, it's got like a really small waiting room and an intake area and a really small exam room. And either the nurse or the doctor oftentimes lives on the upstairs of it. Very, very simple paper medical records. But they know all of their patients, and a typical day for them would be that they take drop-ins or walk-ins in the morning, and then in the afternoon they do home visits. And they are expected, well, what they do is that they visit, each one of their patients gets visited at least once a year at their home, so that they're doing not only kind of a medical visit, but also making sure that, you know, there's food in the house, that there's no dangerous things going on. You know, they'd be looking for domestic violence. They would be, you know, just making sure that everything's okay, or making an assessment about what needs to be done so that when a hurricane comes or any other disaster, they actually know where that patient lives and who's around them, and probably dropped in and met their neighbors and things like that. And that's going to come up again in a little example that I have. Then we would go to the polyclinics. We also would go to the regional hospitals and see how they gear up. And that is very, very similar to ours, where in the Enrique Cabrera Hospital that I visited a couple of times, they have their red treatment areas and yellow treatment areas and green treatment areas already figured out. They actually have the colors along the top of the wall. And the neighborhoods know which entrance to come into the hospital. You know, they actually can't come in the middle of a hurricane, but, you know, when there's an emergency, you know, which entrances will be open and what kind of services they have. And so we visit all of that. And then we also tend to visit the Municipal Emergency Operations Center and see how they set up. And let me tell you, they're very proud of their centers, and they're very, very simple. I mean, you know, we're proud of our EOCs. Their EOC would be like one room with a whiteboard and some battery-operated radios and some battery-operated communication systems and an old Macintosh computer where they can get weather reports. But they are so proud of what they've got, and they make them work. So we were in Central Havana, and the EOC leader, who is also, you know, he's a government person. He's a municipal, he's somewhere in municipal government on a normal basis. We asked him, so how many people do you have that need transportation, you know, before the hurricane comes? And he very quickly said, there are exactly 65 people who need assistance with transportation, and I have all of their names. And we have plans for all of them, so they really know their areas. And then the other thing that we did as responders is we did meet with members of the Henry Reeves Brigade, which was really, really emotional because especially the first group that I took, everybody had been on a major disaster. And a lot of the people who went on the first group had been in Hurricane Katrina. And we were pretty PTSD. We were pretty messed up after the Superdome. And we were meeting with Cubans who had been on any of a number of different international disaster responses. And when we were talking, you know, we would give an example and look in their eyes, and we knew that they knew what we were talking about. And they would give an example of, you know, a patient that they dealt with or a tragedy that they saw or something. And we would look at, you know, we would see, look at each other, and they knew that we understood what they were talking about. It took down all of those barriers, you know, that we see, you know, oh, Cuba, it's communist, you can't go there, you know, they're lying to you and things like that. No, we're disaster responders, they're disaster responders, and we have such common experiences. It was great. As we left, we genuinely hoped that eventually we would work side by side somewhere. When I was in Haiti, I actually did run into some Cuban doctors who were there. They're actually in Haiti all the time. But it was like in passing when I was on my way to the airport. But I never thought I'd see the day, you know, when I would say that we would say these things to each other. This was like maybe 6 years ago. There was no, we thought we're going to say this because we feel it, but there's no possibility. And, you know, Obama just left Havana. And I'm just amazed that maybe there could be a time that a Cuban disaster response team would come to the United States and help us out.
You know, I would hope that. I would hope they would come to some of our disaster conferences and speak about mm-hmm. their system. It just seems the information you're giving us, which fortunately we'll be able to spread to a lot of people, but very few people know how together that country is. And it's a shame because, you know, we don't have a level of communication that we probably will have in the future. But Joe, you know, we've talked a lot about why do disaster responders do what they do? And what is the thing that makes us keep going back? And Barb, I think you nailed it because of the fact that you have that in common, regardless of whether you have the language or anything else in common. You've been there, you've done that, and nobody else gets it. So I don't know. What do you think, Jamie?
Well, I think that, you know, it's something that responders at all levels, I think, get and understand and can communicate. And it's something that I've seen, you know, meeting paramedics and meeting nurses from all over the world. You know, people are people, patients are patients. And, you know, everyone has the same hopes and dreams for their lives. You know, maybe their technology is different and maybe their education levels are different, but or their system of government is different. But when you boil it down to the individual, everyone wants the same things. And so I see that. And I completely understand what you're saying, Barb, which is that, you know, all of these people had a shared experience that they could compare to your shared experience with your team.
Exactly. Yeah. And fortunately, the Cubans also do have a fabulous medical system. And they're really good at MacGyvering because they need to do it every day. So, you know, because they're very primary care based. But when we have the big earthquake here in California, if I ever saw the Henry Reeve Brigade, you know, coming off of a plane, it would just be fabulous because I know how dedicated they are, how grounded they are, how it would be fabulous.
It would be fabulous. I hope we have that opportunity someday. And like I said, I hope they can come and teach us more. So what you were doing there in Cuba wasn't so much like we see in Haiti when they go out and do medical care on a regular basis, but this was a learning expedition, right?
Yes. So, so we did not see patients. They take care of their own patients. It was a learning opportunity to see how they do things and an exchange. The exchange stories. And one of the really reassuring things, too, was that by hearing their stories, we knew that they were really competent clinicians because, you know, we talked about, you know, how they managed, you know, this particular problem, you know, and a compound fracture that, you know, what had been festering for 9 months because it took that long for the gentleman to come down from the mountains. It was so... They're really good clinicians. So I've got two stories to share.
Good. One, I like stories.
Okay. So one is about that, you know, that kind of taught me, that pulled some of this together. So one was that we were meeting with a neighborhood group and the doctor nurse team was there. And so one of the questions that we asked was, so what is your list of vulnerable populations? And, you know, because we're always in the United States, we're always saying, you know, well, it should include this and it shouldn't include that. And then I think, you know, my experience with Katrina was that a lot of the people that I saw who were in a really bad way, they didn't have a medical problem. They just didn't have a car, and that's why they couldn't get out of New Orleans, and that's why they ended up in the floodwaters. So we asked, you know, the question, so who are your vulnerable populations? And they said, vulnerable populations? Yeah, you've got them. We said, no. Who are they? What is your list? What are your diagnoses? And they said, huh? And we said, you know, what are the diagnoses? You know, like people who are blind? And they said, somebody is blind? Sure. He said, like people are pregnant? And they said, sure. And we went back and forth a few times. And then at one point, the nurse said, wait a minute, I got it. I understand what your question is. You want a list, she said. We said, yeah, we want a list of your diagnosis. She said, it's not a list. We said, well, what do you mean? She said, if a patient is blind, but they're with their family, they're not at higher risk. If a patient has diabetes, they could be at risk, but if I get them their medicines and they have food and they're with a neighbor, they're fine. But I could have another gentleman, you know, like the one I talked about earlier, who has no medical problem, but he lives alone and he gets confused. Now, he's at risk until I can get him someplace that I know he'll be taken care of, or I have him come with me when we evacuate. And he said, well, how do you know this stuff? And they just, everybody in the neighborhood group just kind of looked at each other and they smiled and they just said, because we're neighbors. But we know who is confused and we know who needs help. We know who lives alone and we know who, you know, is grumpy and doesn't want to evacuate. And it's not a list. It's knowing the patient and figuring out all of the reasons why they might be at risk. Another interesting thing is that 85% of all Cubans, when they evacuate to the home of either a relative or a neighbor. So they're not like all massing over to, you know, a giant government shelter. And so people who are, so one Cuban told me that when a hurricane's coming, that's when the family all gets together, because they all go over to Uncle Jorge's house, because Uncle Jorge has the strongest house, and it's on a hill. And they bring their, he cooks beforehand, and they bring their rum, and they bring their food, and they bring their kids, and they know that the power is going to go out, and they all get together at Jorge's house because it's strong. And other people say, oh, yeah, I always go up to the neighbors. So people on the first floor evacuate up because of the flooding, and people on the floors above the fourth floor evacuate down because of the winds. And they also expect the power to go out. And they've already got food, and they already got their medicines, and they just kind of hang out together. So we don't have this issue of trying to empty cities that they move people to safety, but they don't empty cities. They might empty a section of a city, but it's a slightly different thing.
That makes so much sense. I mean, it's just mind-boggling that we don't do it that way.
It takes the concept of sheltering in place to a community level. And that's really interesting to me, because I think that it sounds like it works really, really, really well in Cuba. And I wonder how it would be applied here in the United States, because it's going to require a level of community-wide preparedness and understanding that I'm not necessarily sure we're ready to implement here, or we haven't reached that point of community awareness and preparedness for disaster that we probably should. And it's one of the things we talk about a lot here on the show, Barbara, is that level of community preparedness and how each individual needs to be responsible for their own safety and their own medications and making sure they're prepared and have food in the house. And if they need to evacuate because of a certain type of disaster that's impending, like a hurricane or a flood or something, that they know where they're going and have that planned out. But it sounds like in Cuba, that's all planned out and ready to go at the community level. And it's not necessarily the case here, which I think is one of the reasons we have so many people that need evacuation.
And yeah, so when I go out to, my clinics, what I advocate for is that we be, you know, at the community health center level, aware of, okay, if something happens, then who is it that maybe, you know, if we see it coming, you know, is there a patient that we have that's recently been sick and we know that, you know, we're worried about them, then maybe we should take the responsibility to call them. We don't have to, like, rewrite the entire healthcare system, but as their primary care provider, we can try to take, you know, the people who we know are vulnerable to take some responsibility and give them a call. And then the other thing that, you know, I think I mentioned the patient that it wasn't a patient, when I was doing a neighborhood visit, that when I'm talking to people in the community and, you know, I've got elderly people who are just completely confused and they don't have any resources and they don't know where to go, their church or their neighbor or their neighborhood group or their CERT team or, you know, anything that we can cobble together that makes that safety net. You know, we're not going to change the entire system, but we can kind of put a bug in the ear, you know, for the CERT teams to check on everybody that you're going to save lives simply because you went and checked. Or that if somebody, you know, they're confused, just make sure that their neighbor knows to check on them.
And it seems like that's what CERTs do. So maybe we, and mm-hmm. Jamie, your point is really well made. We're trying to teach individuals to be prepared. Maybe we ought to be training neighborhoods. And the CERT program is something that really is at that ground roots level. Maybe we should be encouraging more CERTs and having the CERTs, because they learn everything from search and rescue to first aid and so forth, but really incorporate that checking on everybody, even if they don't know every person in that neighborhood, but define that area of responsibility and assuring that they know ahead of time. This is all about pre-planning. That's where they have it right. Know these people. Know where their meds are. Know something about their medical issues or whether they have seven kids they're going to need assistance getting out of there. I think that's the key. It's just, how do we do it?
Yeah, and so I'm a huge fan of CERT teams. And, you know, I have told them publicly that I think that CERT teams are going to save more lives than DMAT teams. Because they're there in the neighborhood and they can do the quick rescue. They're there to stop bleeding. In Berkeley, I go to, well, not recently, but in the past, we've gone to the schools to teach teachers to organize schools basically as CERT teams so that somebody, you know, a few teachers or other staff volunteer to be the first aiders, and a few volunteer to, you know, do the light search and rescue, and a few and that so that they can be somewhat more self-sufficient. And all I teach them is how to stop bleeding and treat for shock. I don't even teach them all that other stuff because that's the thing that they have to be there. You know, even if the fire department shows up 3 hours later, that kid might have already bled to death. So just simply first aid team, stop bleeding, direct pressures.
And that's pretty much what, you know, that follows the model of active shooter and all of those kinds of things. It's stop bleeding and keep breathing and move on. And I got to wonder, too, Barb, you're bringing back, you're taking teams over there that are learning these things, and I'm sure they're coming back very well inspired. Are they taking this out to their hospitals and to their neighborhoods and to their disaster groups to maybe get some excitement going on and look for some solutions, at least to the extent that they can?
So the group that the two groups that I took actually were California groups. They were mostly people that a lot of them were people that I know, and they have been. And I think that what the Cuba experience does is it takes things that you kind of already knew and it reinforces them, that, you know, and then it gives you the courage to, you know, when you say, when people say, oh, no, we would never do that, we couldn't do that, or it can't be done in the United States, you know, you know, because you've seen it, that this will save lives. And so you have the courage to say, okay, you know, this is in Cuba, but how can we do it? You know, like CERT teams. We've got a whole system for CERT teams. I love it. And I go out and I will go out and do additional training and encouragement to neighborhood groups. I do it all the time, like many times a year, because I believe in the CERT team.
Well, and so you take our DMAT team, which is 100 plus strong, and you incite them with this level of knowledge and get them excited about the concept. And, you know, these are all A-type personalities, so they're not shy about anything. So they go back to their neighborhoods, and they try to maybe not necessarily create a CERT, but go out there and try to get to know their neighbors and to try. I mean, now I'm one of the neighborhoods I used to live with in California, and I'm still watch it. They have a lot of internet-based communication with each other. So, you know, even that is a tool. It's just it's how people will communicate with each other, and it's neighbors getting to know neighbors. So just as an example, everybody on our team goes out and inspires their neighborhood to do something like this. Think how that could multiply.
Yep. And I think sometimes, even at the CERT level, sometimes I think we make it kind of intimidating. You know, people can say, oh, my God, you know, what am I going to do if somebody has something impaled in their chest? Well, even on DMAT, there's a limit to what we can do when somebody's got something impaled in their chest. And so I try to simplify it for them that if you do nothing more, nothing else than, you know, direct pressure, stop bleeding, and treat for shock, you can save lives. And then they say, I can do that. You know, and then if you also know how to splint, if you also know how to do this and that and what to do for burns, that's excellent. But if all you do, you know, is stop bleeding and treat for shock, it's still absolutely fabulous. And then they go, oh, yeah, I can do that. That I can do. When I go and speak at churches, I encourage them to just check on other church members after the earthquake.
And there's a lot to be said for, and I think Jamie would agree, we've touched on this, although it's been a while, but if people know what to do, they're going to be much happier about doing it, even if they don't know a lot. But they'd rather do something than nothing. And if they know nothing, then they're going to run around in circles and become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. So even giving them those basic skills to know what to do is going to make them feel pretty good about themselves. And knowing they could have saved one life or helped one other person, instead of just standing there going, okay, what do I do now? I got to wait for somebody to come rescue me. Jamie, would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, there's a level of complacency in many people here in the United States that just sometimes drives me nuts.
Here. I think we can all agree on that. So Barb, we're going to wind down here pretty quick, but do you have more plans in the future of taking more groups down there?
Yeah, sure. I think it would be fabulous. One of the dreams that I had, and I tried to pull this together, but it didn't quite work, is that the Cubans are way ahead of us in certain areas, and certainly around hurricane, you know, a predictable disaster, they're way ahead of us. But I think that they actually have a really high earthquake risk. You know, they're not that far from, you know, that they're on the same fault as the one that was disastrous in Haiti. And so one of my dreams is to take a group of structural engineers and seismologists, as well as USAR and other healthcare folks, to talk about, okay, you've got a fabulous system. Let's just share a few lessons that we learned about when it's regional, catastrophic, and unannounced, that, you know, there are just a few things that, you know, we've kind of picked up and do in California or whatever, or there are people in other areas that have, you know, different insights.
So, Jamie, it always seems to come back to education and training, doesn't it? And that's pretty much predominantly what we're talking about, learning about their system, taking those lessons, bringing them back, and hopefully educating other people. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of the reasons why I think this show has been as successful as it's been, is because we focus on that aspect of learning lessons from the past and taking lessons from other organizations and other cultures and other areas of even industry. I think there's been a lot learned about things like checklists and stuff like that from the aviation industry that have been brought into emergency response. And so I think that that's important. And one of the reasons why we're really thankful to have Paragon Medical Education Group on the show as our primary sponsor. They have done so much to bring this show here, and we're now into our past our second year, going into our third year here on the show. And it's because of their support that we've done that. And I think it's because of their commitment to this type of experiential training and resources to educate people about what they're doing. So I want to urge people to check them out. If you've got a system that wants to prepare for a given problem, if you're especially with the hot topics that are going on right now with terrorism, active shooters, bombing, and things like that, how do you respond to those man-made disaster events? They are particularly good at that. And so you can reach out to them on their website at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. You can also find them on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU. And you can find them here on the Disaster Podcast. There's a link right on the main page to their site directly. You can also leave comments and questions here on any of the episodes at DisasterPodcast.com. And Joe and the rest of the team from Paragon will respond back and answer your questions. But I highly recommend them. Sam and I have both seen the work they do and the way that they integrate real life experience into their training. It's not just a PowerPoint class. You actually get hands on every single time they come in to do an educational process. So check them out, ParagonMedicalGroup.com. And thanks again for having them as our sponsor. Let them know that you appreciate the Disaster Podcast. So Sam, Barb, it's great to have you guys on the show as we kind of wind down here. Barb, any final words for us?
Yeah, there is. Thanks. So, Sam, I want to answer your last question a little bit better. If anybody, you know, who listens to the podcast is interested in organizing a group to go down to Cuba to, you know, as emergency responders, I've got the connections. I can help you do it. So I don't personally have plans right now, you know, to organize a brand new group and things like that. But if there's a community or an area or a team or whoever that can pull together, you know, 12 to 15 people who are interested in going, I can make it happen for you.
Be careful what you wish for. This goes out to a lot of people, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of them interested.
I would be delighted. You know, I don't hesitate to say that because I think it is so important. And the best, you know, you can listen to this and be skeptical or not, but when you go down, you pick up your own lessons. And so that's why it's so important. Plus, you know, we do want to increase exchange with Cuba, but Sam always knows how to get a hold of me. So if anybody's interested, I can walk you through. And then nowadays, with the changes in regulations, it's even easier. But we have connections through the Ministry of Public Health to make all those connections to the healthcare system and to the emergency response system so that you won't be able to visit these places on your own if you just go on your own.
Do you have a website or an email or some way that people could, you know, we always on the podcast, we have the ability for people to ask questions right on the site, and then we get an email and we can pass them on to you. But if you had a website or anything that they could use as a point of reference for this, that would be awesome.
So I don't have a website. I do have my email. But is that a good idea to put that out on a podcast?
Well, no, I think what you can do is we'll just urge people to leave a comment on disasterpodcast.com and we'll forward that to you. And you can go back and leave your own comment in response. And you'll also have their email to respond back to them as well.
That sounds great. Happy to do that.
Perfect. And I know, Barb, we've just scratched the surface on all the wonderful things you do. So I'm really hoping we can get you back on for a sojourn through Haiti or some of your other adventures and even talk more about Cuba, because I think you probably have more you can tell us.
I could talk about Cuba for days.
Well, we'll find days. We just have to break it up in segments. So we will definitely get you back on again.
Experience in more ways than one.
Well, we're so happy you came up to share that with us. And I really think our listeners are going to enjoy that too and hopefully want more.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So, Sam, no problem. Sam, where can folks find you?
In the usual social media places, SamBradley11 or Sam Bradley, Twitter, Facebook, whatever else. And certainly on the disasterpodcast.com, which again, we encourage you to come up and let us know what you think of this episode. Ask us any questions you want us to have Barbara get back to you on. Any questions on anything else she's doing and any questions in general or any subject matter that you would like us to look into or guests that you would like us to pursue, anything at all. Jamie?
You can always find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media places. So look me up, and it's great to have you all join us. And Barb, thanks again for coming on the show. We will be back again every Thursday. We come out with a new episode, so you can go over to disasterpodcast.com. You can actually sign up for an email notification. Right at the top of the page, there's an email location for our newsletter there. And that just simply sends you a notification when a new episode comes out, so you can go and check it out for yourself. That's it for me. Sam, you know, sounds like Cuba's got a good handle on this, and they've kind of redefined what disaster medicine looks like.
Boy, and I was just, even though I knew a little bit about this, they just so have it together. I mean, we have so much we can learn from them, and I'm glad that Barbara is letting people know about this in her various ways. So hopefully we'll hear more about it. But it's very clear on whatever level we're discussing, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.